Welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Can you believe Thanksgiving is this coming week? The season is upon us and we're not ready. But we'll soldier on into the social and shopping fray. As the season counts down, I'll be suggesting books that will make treasured stocking stuffers. Today, we kick it all off with books people will be talking about at family gatherings, office holiday parties, or dinners out with friends. When the conversation turns to books, and we hope it will, count on the book report for the prep you'll need. And then there's food prep for all your entertaining. We've got some ideas on that, too. Matthew Gavin Frank drops by to speak about his latest, The Mad Feast, an ecstatic tour through America's food. Let's turn now to page one of the book report. My Brilliant Friend is a modern masterpiece from one of Italy's most acclaimed authors, Elena Ferrante. Book one in the Neapolitan novels is an intense, generous-hearted story about two friends, Elena and Lila, who represent the story of a nation and the nature of friendship. The story begins in the 1950s in a poor but vibrant neighborhood in Naples. Growing up on these tough streets, the two girls learn to rely on each other. As they grow and as their paths repeatedly diverge and converge, Elena and Lila remain best friends whose respective destinies are reflected and refracted in the other. They are the embodiments of a nation undergoing momentous change. Hilary Huber performs the book.
Days passed. I looked at my email, at my regular mail, but not with any hope. I often wrote to her, and she almost never responded. This was her habit. She preferred the telephone or long nights of talk when I went to Naples. I opened my drawers, the metal boxes where I keep all kinds of things. Not much there. I've thrown away a lot of stuff, especially anything that had to do with her, and she knows it. I discovered that I have nothing of hers, not a picture, not a note. Not a little gift. I was surprised myself. Is it possible that in all those years she left me nothing of herself? Or worse, that I didn't want to keep anything of her? It is. This time I telephoned Reno. I did it unwillingly. He didn't answer on the house phone or on his cell phone. He called me in the evening when it was convenient. He spoke in the tone of voice he uses to arouse pity. I saw that you called. Do you have any news? No, do you? Nothing. He rambled incoherently. He wanted to go on TV, on the show that looks for missing persons, make an appeal, ask his mama's forgiveness for everything, beg her to return. I listened patiently, then asked him, "Did you look in her closet?" "What for?" Naturally, the most obvious thing would never occur to him. "Go and look." He went, and he realized that there was nothing there. Not one of his mother's dresses, summer or winter, only old hangers. I sent him to search the whole house. Her shoes were gone. The few books, gone. All the photographs, gone. The movies, gone. Her computer had disappeared, including the old-fashioned diskettes and everything. Everything to do with her experience as an electronics wizard who had begun to operate computers in the late 60s, in the days of punch cards. Reno was astonished. I said to him, "Take as much time as you want. But then call and tell me if you found even a single hairpin that belongs to her." He called the next day, greatly agitated. "There's nothing."
"Nothing at all?"
"No. She cut herself out of all the photographs of the two of us, even those from when I was little."
"You looked carefully?"
"Everywhere."
"Even in the cellar?"
"I told you, everywhere. And the box with her papers is gone. I don't know. Old birth certificates, telephone bills, receipts. What does it mean?
Did someone steal everything? What are they looking for? What do they want from my mother and me? I reassured him. I told him to calm down. It was unlikely that anyone wanted anything, especially from him. Can I come and stay with you for a while? No, please, I can't sleep. That's your problem, Reno. I don't know what to do about it. I hung up, and when he called back, I didn't answer. I sat down at my desk. Leela is overdoing it as usual, I thought. She is expanding the concept of trace out of all proportion. She wanted not only to disappear herself, now at the age of 66, but also to eliminate the entire life that she had left behind. I was really angry. We'll see who wins this time, I said to myself. I turned on the computer and began to write all the details of our story. Everything that still remained in my memory.
That was My Brilliant Friend by Elena Ferrante. Matthew Gavin Frank is an essayist who's written about everything from Italian winemaking to the social hierarchies of a pot farm in California. Matt lives in Marquette, Michigan, and teaches creative writing there. Today we'll speak with Matt about his new book, The Mad Feast, an ecstatic tour through America's food. Matthew, welcome to the Book Report.
Thank you so much for having me, Elaine.
Firstly, congrats on the New York Times review of your first book. They wrote, "There is some stunning writing and perversely wonderful research along the way."
Thank you so much.
So, Matthew, what made you go from writing about giant squids and preparing the ghost to chronicling America's iconic recipes?
Well, Elaine, I have spent most of my occupational life working in restaurant kitchens, actually. I got my first restaurant job at age 11, washing dishes in a fast food chicken shack on the outskirts of Chicago, and then just kind of stayed in the industry on and off for the next 20 years. So I've long been working with food and thinking about food. I come from a long line of folks who suffer from a bit of OCD, so that kind of translated into an obsession with food, and I started writing about it. And even before I exhausted my obsession with the giant squid, I wrote a series of articles on food for a number of various magazines and publications. So it was fun to return to this subject and engage it in book form.
You describe the book as a spastic, lyrical, anti-cookbook cookbook of sorts that also may be a revisionist take on U.S. history. Phew, I got that out. How so?
Well, I actually felt, as I was researching this book, kind of like a private eye. As I was going from state to state, I actually did visit all 50 states. In order to uncover a larger statement about why we eat, where we eat, how we eat, and what we eat in a particular region, and how a particular foodstuff got to be popular in a particular U.S. region, and what sort of U.S. history I would have to uncover in order to stumble toward the answers to those questions. And so there is a lot of U.S. regional history in the book, since that during my research process I found that what went on in each particular state in its long journey to the present oftentimes impacted what we ate there and in turn how we eat today.
Okay, so in South Carolina, for example, you spotlight purlieu, which you describe as sister to jambalaya, brother to pilaf, cousin to paella, to risotto biryani. And then you go on to reference Strom Thurmond's record-setting filibuster in the Senate. How did you make that leap?
I had to discuss, once again, the context in which that foodstuff is embedded. And so since purlieu basically derives from a lot of the African-American diaspora that was related to a lot of the history of slavery in South Carolina. Strom Thurmond kind of attached to that engagement, as did the taking down of the Confederate flag.
How did you identify the locals who helped you in determining which dish to focus on in each of the 50 states?
That is a good question, and everything was situation-specific. Sometimes I found folks who were just incredibly interesting from the get-go and passionate about a particular foodstuff in their state, and sometimes I just had to tumble down the rabbit hole and basically interview, say, a family member who of mine who would then in turn tell me about a friend of theirs who was living in Charleston, South Carolina in the 60s, and then that person happened to be friends with a chef who was working in Charleston, South Carolina in the 70s, and so basically it was like leaping from ice floe to ice floe and tumbling down the rabbit hole of what at a certain point seemed to be a seemingly endless series of interviews.
We're speaking with Matthew Gavin Frank on The Book Report. You seem to have gone off the rails in New Jersey. What is it about the state or their recipe that set you off?
First of all, the New Jersey recipe is for the New Jersey Ripper, which, to simplify, is a deep-fried hot dog. And so the hot dog actually has to be prepared specially with a much, much thicker casing. And there are only a couple different companies in the New Jersey area that do it. Rutt's Hut is the famed outpost in Jersey for the Ripper, and the owner of Rutt's Hut is famously cantankerous. And actually, when I was trying to conduct a series of interviews with him, failed interviews with him, he hung up on me a number of times. And I actually had some research assistants and interns working for me when I was putting the book together. And they got hung up on, too. When he found out I was from Chicago, a city which prizes its own version of the hot dog, this guy Johnny, he would identify himself only as Johnny, who runs Rutt's Hut, kind of went off the rails himself and deviated from the interview in progress and just started ripping on the Chicago hot dogs. So perhaps the essay was a reaction to the off the rails research experience I was having.
Have you ever met Anthony Bourdain, or was there someone else who inspired the book?
I never met Anthony Bourdain, but I would say the late, great chef Charlie Trotter. He was a Chicago chef, and I worked for him for a bit in Chicago. Was a great inspiration to me. When I worked for him, he would challenge chefs in the fine dining kitchen to take two seemingly dissimilar ingredients in the kitchen, say lamb loin and burnt orange rind, and then to work to find the perfect bridge ingredient in order to connect those two into a unified and sublime taste on the plate. It turned out that perfect bridge ingredient was black olive sorbet. But I feel like I adopted that technique in the writing process of this book, too. Where oftentimes I would take two seemingly dissimilar things, a particular foodstuff, and then the kind of wayward and eye-popping history that was responsible for the foodstuff in that state, and I would have to find ways to connect those seemingly dissimilar narrative threads.
What's next for you?
I'm actually working on a book about carrier pigeons and their role in diamond smuggling, in the diamond smuggling syndicates. So I'm doing a lot of research, actually, in southern and western Africa for that.
Wow. Matt, your book was so much fun to read. I want to really thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Elaine, for having me.
All righty. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
The Bocuse d'Or is the real-life Top Chef, a biannual cooking competition in France featuring teams from 24 countries. Named after famous chef Paul Bocuse, the Bocuse d'Or has become the most sophisticated and closely watched cook-off in the world. Ironically, though American cuisine now rates among the best in the world, a U.S. team had never placed among the top three in the competition. In 2008, under the auspices of renowned chefs Danielle Beaulieu and Thomas Keller, the two-person U.S. team of Timothy Hollingsworth and Adina Guest trained for the 2009 competition with the goal of a best-ever U.S. showing. With unparalleled behind-the-scenes access, the book follows the American contestants and the other hopefuls as they train to cook and serve their dishes over the course of 5.5 tense hours in an arena filled with 1,000 screaming spectators. Along the way, Friedman paints intimate portraits of Beaulieu and Keller, two of the leading culinary figures of their generation. Sean Rennett narrates.
In the Bocuse d'Or's current form, 24 teams, each comprising of a chef and a commis, or assistant, compete. The only thing they know for certain when they begin is that three of them will emerge with precious medals, while the others will slink home empty-handed. Despite these odds, the Bocuse d'Or draws professionals, many from top kitchens who already toil in pressure cooker environments, subsist on precious little sleep, and subject themselves to dozens, even hundreds, of verdicts every working day. Any number of clichés may explain the appeal of the Bocuse d'Or. Chefs love a challenge. Chefs are competitive. Chefs are masochists. All are appealing. But none fits the entire field. Just as people get into cooking for different reasons, there's no single motive for pursuing this culinary holy grail. Candidates are philosophically unified, however, when they come out on the other side. "I learned a lot about myself" is perhaps the most common sentence uttered by those who have vied for the Bocuse d'Or when asked to evaluate their experience. This doesn't surprise Roland Ennen, who coached Team USA at the 2009 edition. "Competition doesn't form character," Ennen is fond of saying. "Competition reveals character." An American team has competed at every Bocuse d'Or, but the United States has not yet reached the elusive podium, where gold, silver, and bronze medalists are bathed in a light storm of glitter and flashbulbs. In 2008, a triumvirate of culinary figures, Danielle Beaulieu, Thomas Keller, and Jérôme Bocuse, raised unprecedented support and awareness for the American enterprise. This is their story, and the story of the team that competed for the United States at the 2009 Bocuse d'Or, what they did, how they did it, and what they learned. Timothy Hollingsworth, chef de cuisine at Thomas Keller's landmark restaurant, The French Laundry, in Yountville, California, calls the highest state of kitchen being the dance. It's a phrase he learned from Keller himself, described in the restaurant's employee manual as the way each of us interacts with the other, crucial in the flow of a great kitchen. The dance, as Hollingsworth interprets it, can take many forms. There's the synchronicity of a kitchen brigade firing on all cylinders, the cooks complementing, if not actually completing, each other's tasks, picking up food, plating food, sometimes even cooking food for the person next to them. It can and should look like a naturally occurring phenomenon, but is achieved only with great and sustained effort. There is also an individual dance in which a cook experiences the exhilaration of peak performance, operating on pure instinct, all of his senses integrated seemingly without the middleman of a brain. Preparations are stirred, sniffed, adjusted, tossed, approved, plated, and then forgotten as he undertakes the next order. Hollingsworth likens this iteration of the dance to the quintessential image of a football running back, the ball clutched tightly to his chest, charging past linesmen, spinning and weaving his way around or through an onslaught of defenders. In movies, that moment is often depicted in slow motion, the way it may feel to the athlete, and the only way for an outsider to fully appreciate its intricacies. But time is actually moving faster, as the running back makes a series of nanosecond decisions and infinitesimal adjustments. Hollingsworth regularly attains the dance at the French Laundry. But on January 28, 2009, at the Bocuse d'Or, the most pressure-filled day of his young life, Hollingsworth wasn't dancing. He moved with assurance, grace even, but any co-worker would recognize that he wasn't swaying or ever so slightly swaggering as he moved from one side of the kitchen to the other, the way he did when he was in the zone. He wasn't quite lost in his work, wasn't flowing naturally from one movement to the next. Instead, he seemed to be thinking about the long list of tasks before him, whether alternating avocado and diced shrimp shingles atop a rectangle of puff pastry or overlaying a sheet of poached cod mousse with pureed scallop roe.
That was Knives at Dawn by Andrew Friedman. As previously mentioned, the shopping season is about to get underway. So, what better time to enjoy Book 8 in the Sophie Kinsella adorable Shopaholic series? In Shopaholic to the Rescue, Becky Brandon sets off on a hilarious road trip through the American West to Las Vegas. Becky's dad has vanished from L.A. on a mysterious quest with her best friend's husband. Becky's mom is hysterical. Her best friend, Suze, is desperate. Worse, Becky must tolerate an enemy along for the ride, a certain someone whom Becky knows is up to no good. Determined to get to the bottom of her dad's disappearance and reunite her fractured family, Becky must marshal all her ingenuity for her most outrageous and daring plan yet. Claire Corbett performs the book.
Heart starts to thump, and I automatically start searching around for a hiding place. Okay, maybe this is a slight overreaction, but I've always been nervy around policemen, ever since I smuggled 6 pairs of Dolly's shoes out of Hamley's, aged 5, and a policeman came up to me and boomed,
"What have you got there, young lady?"
And I nearly jumped out of my skin. He was admiring my helium balloon, it turned out. We sent the Dolly's shoes back in a padded envelope after Mum and Dad found them, with a letter of apology, which I wrote myself. And then Hamley's wrote back and said,
"Don't worry,"
very nicely. I think that's the first time I realised that writing a letter is actually a very good way to get yourself out of a tricky situation. "Luke," I mutter urgently, "quick! Are we supposed to bribe them? How much cash have we got?"
"Becky," says Luke patiently, "I said don't panic. There'll be a perfectly good reason why they've pulled us over."
"Should we all get out?" says Suze.
"I say we stay in the vehicle," says Janice, sounding edgy. "I say we act perfectly normal, as though we've got nothing to hide."
"We have got nothing to hide," says Alicia, sounding exasperated.
"Everyone needs to relax."
"They've got guns," says Mum wildly, peering out of the window. "Guns, Janice!"
"Jane, please calm down," says Luke. "I'll go and talk to them."
He gets out of the RV, and the rest of us look around at one another anxiously. I'm travelling with my best friend Suze, my very much unbest friend Alicia, my daughter Minnie, my mum, and her best friend Janice. We're on our way to Las Vegas from LA, and already we've argued about the air conditioning, the seating arrangements, and whether Janice should be allowed to play Celtic pipe music to calm her nerves. Answer, no. 5 votes to 1. It's a tad fraught, this road trip, and we've only been going for 2 hours. And now this. I watch as the cop approaches Luke and starts talking.
"Doggy," says Minnie, pointing out of the window. "Big, big, big doggy."
A second cop has come up to Luke with an intimidating-looking police dog. It's a German shepherd and is sniffing around Luke's feet. Suddenly, it looks up at the RV and barks.
"Oh, God!"
Janice emits an anguished cry.
"I knew it. It's the narcotics squad. They're going to sniff me out."
"What?" I turn to stare at her. Janice is a middle-aged lady who likes flower arranging and doing people's makeup in lurid shades of peach. What does she mean, sniff her out?
"I'm sorry to have to tell you, everybody,"
she gulps dramatically,
"but I have illicit drugs about my person."
For a moment, nobody moves. My brain is refusing to compute these two elements. Illicit drugs. Janice.
"Drugs?"
Mum exclaims. "Janice, what are you talking about?"
"The jet lag,"
Janice moans.
"My doctor was so unhelpful, I had to resort to the internet.
Annabelle at the Bridge Club gave me the website, but it had a disclaimer. May be prohibited in certain countries. And now that dog will sniff them out and we'll get hauled in for questioning.
She breaks off at the sound of frenzied barking. I have to admit, the police dog seems quite keen on coming over to the RV. It's pulling on its leash and yelping, and the policeman keeps looking down at it in irritation.
You bought prohibited drugs, Suze explodes. Why would you do that?
Janice, you're going to jeopardise the whole trip.
Mum sounds apoplectic.
How could you bring Class A drugs into America?
I'm sure they're not Class A, I say, but Mum and Janice are too hysterical to listen.
Get rid of them,
Mum is saying shrilly.
Now! Here they are.
Janice takes two white packets out of her bag, her hands fumbling.
I never would have brought them if I'd known. Well, what shall we do with them?
Demands Mum.
Everyone swallow one blister pack, says Janice, pulling them out of the boxes in agitation. That's the only thing we can do.
Are you nuts?
Retorts Suze furiously.
I'm not swallowing unlicensed tablets from the internet.
Janice, you have to dispose of them, says Mum. Get out and scatter them by the side of the road. I'll distract the police. No, we'll all distract the police. Everybody out of the RV, now!
The police will notice,
wails Janice.
No, the police won't notice, says Mum firmly. Do you hear me, Janice? The police won't notice. Not if you're quick.
That was a sampling of Shopaholic to the Rescue by Sophie Kinsella. In 1937, F. Scott Fitzgerald was a troubled, uncertain man whose literary success was long over. In poor health, with his wife consigned to a mental asylum and his finances in ruins, he struggled to start over as a screenwriter in Hollywood. By December 1940, he would be dead of a heart attack. The last 3 years of Fitzgerald's life have often been obscured by the legend of his earlier Jazz Age glamour. But this time period is the focus of Stuart Onan's novel West of Sunset. With flashbacks to key moments from Fitzgerald's past, the story follows him as he arrives on the MGM lot, falls in love with gossip columnist Sheila Graham, begins work on The Last Tycoon, and tries to maintain a semblance of family life with the absent Zelda and daughter Scotty. Fitzgerald's orbit of literary fame in the golden age of Hollywood is brought vividly to life through the novel's stellar cast of characters, from Dorothy Parker and Ernest Hemingway to Humphrey Bogart. Christopher Lane performs this compelling portrait of a flawed man who never gave up, even as he saw his wishes and hopes thwarted.
The patients woke before dawn like farmers. At 9, they played tennis. At 11, they painted. The idea was to keep her regimented, which he understood, having disciplined himself to write, though otherwise his life had lost any semblance of order. At 40, by a series of setbacks he ascribed to bad luck, he had become a transient. With Scotty off at her boarding school, he no longer had to keep a house, a relief, since it meant one less expenditure, except now they had no home to go back to, their most cherished possessions given up to musty storage. He'd pared down where he could, and still there was no way he could pay both the hospital and Scotty's tuition, but, out of misplaced honor or plain delusion, he refused to skimp on his responsibilities. It would be too easy. Every month Zelda's mother petitioned him to let her come home to Montgomery. She wasn't ready, if she'd ever be. His hope was that Dr. Carroll would help her get well so he could go to Hollywood and make enough to cover his debts and maybe buy himself time to write the novel he owed Max. There was interest at Metro, the promise of $1,000 a week, but so far Ober couldn't get them to commit. He had to be honest with Scott. The studio had concerns about his drinking. His own fault for publishing those mea culpas in Esquire. All March he pestered Ober for word, assuring him he hadn't touched a drop when his bottom drawer was heavy with empties. With Zelda, everything was a test. For their anniversary, they were allowed to take a day trip to Chimney Rock. He was to be both husband and chaperone, charged with cataloging her conduct, speech, and intake, observations he registered automatically yet resented sharing, as if, after so long in captivity, they had a shred of privacy left. It was a balmy Saturday, the dogwoods frilled with pink, the visitor's lot busy with gussied-up loved ones toting picnic baskets. Dr. Carroll himself delivered her to the front desk, handing her over to Scott like a doting father. In her 20s, baby-faced and petite, she'd seemed girlish. She'd been an athlete and a dancer, a notorious flirt, her stamina and fearlessness irresistible. Now, just shy of 37, she was pinched and haggard, crone-like, her smile ruined by a broken tooth. Some well-meaning soul had fixed her hair for the occasion, gathering the unruly honey-blonde mop back into a knitted black snood which sat cat-like on one shoulder, a style he'd seen on shop girls and waitresses, but one she would never choose, especially since it made her face even sharper, hawkish. The carmine sundress was an old favorite, though it had faded from hard washing and hung on her robe-like, the yoke of her collarbone hollowed, a sheer scarf knotted like a choker to conceal her throat. When he leaned down to greet her, she turned her face into his, her lips grazing his cheek. "Thank you," she said, pulling away, as if he'd done her a favor. "Happy anniversary." "Oh, Dodo, happy anniversary." It always surprised him to hear her soft Dixie lilt coming from this wizened stranger, as if hiding somewhere inside, his fresh wild Zelda still existed. The doctor congratulated them. "How many years is it?"
17, she said, looking to Scott to check her math.
17 years, he confirmed, nodding, uncertain if this fact was happy. The number was as illusory as their marriage. As his wife, she'd now been hospitalized as long as not, and in fretful moments the question of whether she'd been mad all along, and he attracted to that madness, unsettled him. "Enjoy yourselves," the doctor said. "We will," she said, and took Scott's hand, squeezing it as they walked through the vaulted lobby and into the bright day, relinquishing it only when he opened the car door and helped her in like a footman.
That was a sampling of West of Sunset by Stuart Onan. One of the top-selling books of 2015, Do No Harm by leading neurosurgeon Henry Marsh, reveals the fierce joy of operating, the profoundly moving triumphs, the harrowing disasters, the haunting regrets, and the moments of black humor that characterize a brain surgeon's life. When a book opens with the line, "I often have to cut into the brain, and it's something I hate doing," you really can't let it go. You have to read on. If you believe that brain surgery is a precise and exquisite craft practiced by calm and detached surgeons, this brutally honest account, performed by Jim Barclay, will make you think again.
Brain surgery is dangerous, and modern technology has only reduced the risk to a certain extent. I can use a form of GPS for brain surgery called computer navigation, where, like satellites orbiting the Earth, infrared cameras face the patient's head. The cameras can see the instruments in my hands, which have little reflected balls attached to them. A computer connected to the cameras then shows me the position of my instruments in my patient's brain on a scan done shortly before the operation. I can operate with the patient awake under local anaesthetic so that I can identify the eloquent areas of the brain by stimulating the brain with an electrode. The patient is given simple tasks to perform by my anaesthetist so that we can see if I am causing any damage as the operation proceeds. If I'm operating on the spinal cord, which is even more vulnerable than the brain, I can use a method of electrical stimulation known as evoked potentials to warn me if I'm about to cause paralysis. Despite all this technology, neurosurgery is still dangerous. Skill and experience are still required as my instruments sink into the brain or spinal cord, and I must know when to stop. Often it is better to leave the patient's disease to run its natural course and not to operate at all. And then there is luck, both good luck and bad luck. And as I become more and more experienced, it seems that luck becomes ever more important. I had a patient to operate on with a tumour of the pineal gland. In the 17th century, the dualist philosopher Descartes, who argued that mind and brain are entirely separate entities, placed the human soul in the pineal gland. It was here, he said, that the material brain, in some magical and mysterious way, communicates with the mind and with the immaterial soul. I don't know what he would have said if he could have seen my patients looking at their own brains on a video monitor, as some of them do when I operate under local anaesthetic. Pineal tumours are very rare. They can be benign and they can be malignant. The benign ones do not necessarily need treatment. The malignant ones can be treated with radiotherapy and chemotherapy, but can still prove fatal. In the past, they were considered to be inoperable, but with modern microscopic neurosurgery, this is no longer the case. It is usually now thought necessary to operate at least to obtain a biopsy and confirm the type of tumour so that you can decide how best to treat the patient. The pineal is buried deep in the middle of the brain, so the operation is, as surgeons say, a challenge. Neurosurgeons look at brain scans showing pineal tumours with both fear and excitement, like mountaineers looking up at a great peak that they hope to climb. This particular patient had found it very hard to accept that he had a life-threatening illness and that his life was now out of his control. He was a high-powered company director. He had thought that the headaches which had started to wake him at night were caused by the stress of having had to sack so many of his employees in the aftermath of the financial crash of 2008. It turned out that he had a pineal tumour and acute hydrocephalus. The tumour was obstructing the normal circulation of cerebrospinal fluid around his brain, and the trapped fluid was increasing the pressure in his head. Without treatment, he would go blind and die within a matter of weeks.
That was Do No Harm by Henry Marsh. Ally, My Journey Across the American-Israeli Divide, is Michael Oren's memoir of his time as Israel's ambassador to the U.S. from 2009 to 2013. An American by birth and a historian by training, Oren arrived at his diplomatic post just as Benjamin Netanyahu, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton assumed office. During Oren's tenure, Israel and America grappled with the Palestinian peace process, the Arab Spring, and threats to Israel posed by international terrorism and the Iranian nuclear program. Ally, performed by the author, is written from the perspective of a man who treasures his American identity while proudly serving the Jewish state he's come to call home.
This is the story of that journey. It crosses two countries and spans their extraordinary relationship. The United States and Israel are bound by ideas far older than both, by values they commonly cherish and interests they have come to share. Theirs is the deepest bilateral friendship that either has sustained since Israel's founding in 1948, and the reasons are many-sided and profound. In addition to a spiritual affinity unrivaled by that between any modern nations, Israel and the United States are akin in their commitment to democracy. Listeners to Israel's Declaration of Independence can easily hear the echoes of 1776. In America, Israel has an immensely generous source of diplomatic support and annual defense aid. In Israel, the United States has a stable, loyal, and militarily proficient asset, a scientific and technological powerhouse, and a pro-American island in an often toxic sea. Surveys regularly show that Americans and Israelis lead the world in patriotism and in their willingness to fight for their country. They are ideologically, strategically, and naturally allied. Ally is a simple, beautiful word. It evokes warmth, indeed fraternity, and its meaning is invariably positive. One may be a partner, but never an ally in crime. Ally's Hebrew counterpart is even simpler and more stirring. Ben Brit, literally the son of the covenant, recalls the circumcision rite, and beyond that, the Jewish people's special relationship with God. Fittingly, a special relationship is said to exist between Israel and the United States. And like its biblical precedent, that Brit is both physical and eternal, or at least in theory. For the reality is that, alongside their immemorial ties, the U.S.-Israel relationship includes bitter differences. The United States does not recognize Israel's capital or its claim to large parts of the ancestral Jewish homeland. Israel frequently disagrees with America's approach to peacemaking with the Palestinians and its friendship with Middle Eastern rulers who are technically or actively at war with the Jewish state. Vocal segments of the American Jewish community, a vital component in the alliance, are critical of Israeli actions, while Israel, in turn, does not validate the ways in which many of those Jews practice their religion. Israel is a contentious issue in the American press and on many American campuses. In recent years, public disagreements between the two countries' leaders have become commonplace. America and Israel are allies in the most meaningful sense, yet their alliance is scored with divides. This is the story of that alliance, and also its divides, as experienced by one who treasures his American identity while proudly serving the state of Israel. My personal journey intertwines with that story, and never more intimately than during the more than 4 years, from mid-2009 to late-2013, that I represented Israel in Washington. This was a transformative period for America and a time of violent revolutions throughout the Middle East. Hundreds of thousands of the region's people were killed, and the lives of millions more threatened. Israel and America grappled not only with the peace process and other complex bilateral issues, but with the terrorism and Iranian nuclearization that imperiled the world. The alliance would be subjected to enormous strains, and its future questioned by commentators in both countries. On more than one occasion, the friendship's very fabric seemed close to unraveling.
That was Ally by Michael B. Oren. Travel is so top of mind this time of year. So here's a treat from Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Bragg. My Southern Journey is a poignant, funny collection of essays on Southern life. Keenly observed and written with his trademark sense of humor, Bragg, who performs the book, explores enduring Southern truths about home, place, spirit, table, and the region's varied geographies, from his native Alabama to Cajun country and the Gulf Coast. Everything is explored, from regional obsessions with college football to fishing to mayonnaise. Collected from over a decade of his writing, with many never-before-published essays, My Southern Journey is entertaining and engaging and makes a great gift for Southerners or Southerners at heart.
I love tomato sandwiches and fried oyster po' boys and pineapple upside-down cake and biscuits and sausage gravy. And I love the Southern doctor who offers me antidotes and prayer. I love roiling cauldrons of pork cracklings on the first frost, and great pits lined with smoking, fat-dripping pigs, and jars of crabapple jelly that gleam like gold in my mother's windowsill. I love old women who talk tools and transmissions over black coffee in the huddle house, and pass around their heirloom pocket knives with more pride than they do pictures of their grandchildren. I love big-haired waitresses who call me baby, and fat Shriners who ride little bitty cars in the Christmas parade, and stained and faded recipes for tea cakes passed down from the Yankee War. I love lightning bugs. I love winter without snowdrifts, grief, and pain. I love the Delta and its empty, uncluttered land. Love a recidivist guitar man named T-Model Ford who, when asked how many men he'd killed, asked if it counted if he'd done it with a Pontiac. I love the music of Hank Williams and the Mockingbird of Harper Lee and a Louisiana accordion player named Rosie LeDay. I love to see a speckled trout fight the line through the flats of Tampa Bay. Love the black dirt of the lower south and the blood-red clay of the highlands and the glittering white sand of the Gulf. Love the smell of sawmills and the ever-fading, irreplaceable shake and stamp of the cotton mills and what is left of the broad-shouldered south of my boyhood. I love all-night gospel singings and flea markets 4 miles wide and hounds that wail on the mountainside while the raccoons they chase double back on the trail and steal the cat food off the front porch. I love Café au lait and clanking, squealing streetcars and boiled blue crabs too hot to touch. I love the summer times that smell of bourbon and orange slices and crushed cherries, that old clinging waif to decay. I love the scent of a million flowers, a riot of flowers whose names I have never taken time to truly know. I love, I guess, more than anything, the ghosts of my people. Spirits who are always close, always riding in my memory like a good luck charm in my pocket. Like the late aunt who will forever walk between rows of red and yellow roses on the Alabama coast, whispering to her elderly sisters, who hold tightly to both her hands, that they are the most beautiful roses she has ever seen. It is the South. And so spirits are welcome here. You have to love that, too. Because, despite what they believe in Savannah, the party does sometimes end. No matter how deep your to-go cup might be as you warble down the street, there are times when I cannot escape the melancholy of this place, like when I drive the seemingly endless blacktop between walls of dark, between the curtains of the pine barrens and the silver-white glow of the vast cotton fields and other lonely stretches where even the glares of Atlanta, Raleigh, and New Orleans are snuffed out by the sheer breadth of the empty miles. To be a Southerner, or to live Southern, is to feel something. Something special even in the quiet. Something fine in itself after all those rebel yells and roll tides have finally faded into silence. The great Texas writer Larry McMurtry once wrote of a man born beside a river of melancholy, and I've always loved that line. To be a Southerner, born or replanted here by fate, is to drive through the stillness of landscape and spirit and feel it. And we mumble a few lines of a song from childhood to gather the ghosts of our tribe around us.
We've just heard My Southern Journey by Rick Bragg. Readers, should you find time to read during these busy weeks, check my website, bookreportradio.com, for suggestions across the genres. Thanks so much for joining me today. Enjoy the turkey, all the trimmings, and most of all, the treasured moments with those you love. See you in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.